Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Lurie, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do some Hector Human Row, the complete stories of Saki, and we'll do four stories as usual. Most of his stuff is about the same length if you average it over four stories. First story we will do is The Wolves of Cernogratz, C-E-R-N-O-G-R-A-T-Z. Like a lot of his stories, it takes place in Central Europe. Are there any old legends attached to the castle? Asked Conrad of his sister. Conrad was a prosperous Hamburg merchant, but he was the one poetically dispositioned member of an eminently practical family. The Baroness Grubel shrugged her plump shoulders. There are always legends hanging about these old places. They are not difficult to invent, and they cost nothing. In this case, there is a story that when anyone dies in the castle, all the dogs in the village and the wild beasts in the forest howl the night long. It would not be pleasant to listen to, would it? It would be weird and romantic, said the Hamburg merchant. Anyhow, it isn't true, said the Baroness complacently. Since we brought the place, we have had proof that nothing of the sort happens. When the old mother-in-law died last springtime, we all listened, but there was no howling. It is just a story that lends dignity to the place without costing anything. You know, Austria's up in the Alps, covered with forest. Assuming it's Austria. I'm not even sure where Cernogratz is, actually, or if it's even a real place. But it would be somewhere around there. The story is not as you have told it, said Amelie, the gray old governess. Everyone turned around and looked at her in astonishment. She was wont to sit silent and prim and faded in her place at the table, never speaking unless someone spoke to her, and there were few who troubled themselves to make conversation with her. Today, a sudden volubility had descended on her. She continued to talk rapidly and nervously, looking straight in front of her and seeming to address no one in particular. It is not when anyone dies in the castle that the howling is heard. It was when one of the Cernogratz family died here that the wolves came from far and near and howled at the edge of the forest just before the death hour. There were only a few of wolves that had their lairs in this part of the forest. But at such a time, the keepers say there would be scores of them gliding about in the shadows and howling in chorus, and the dogs of the castle and the village and all the farms round would bay and howl in fear and anger at the wolf chorus. And as the soul of the dying one left its body, a tree would crash down in the park. That is what happened when a Cernogratz died in his family castle. But for a stranger dying here, of course no wolf would howl and no tree would follow, no. There was a note of defiance, almost of contempt, in her voice as she said the last words. The well-fed, much too well-dressed Baroness stared angrily at the dowdy old woman who had come forth from her usual and seemly position of effacement to speak so disrespectfully. "You seem to know quite a lot about the von Cernogratz legends, Fräulein Schmidt," she said sharply. "I did not know that family histories were among the subjects you were supposed to be proficient in." The answer to her taunt was even more unexpected and astonishing than the conversational outbreak which had provoked it. "I am a von Cernogratz myself," said the old woman. "That is why I know the family history." "You? A von Cernogratz? You?" came in an incredulous chorus. "When we became very poor," she explained, "and I had to go out and give teaching lessons, I took another name. I thought it would be more in keeping. But my grandfather spent much of his time as a boy in this castle, and my father used to tell me many stories about it, and of course, I knew all the family legends and stories. When one has nothing left to one but memories, one guards and dusts them with a special care. I little thought when I took service with you that I should one day come with you to the old home of my family. I could wish it had been anywhere else." There was a silence when she finished speaking, and then the Baroness turned the conversation to a less embarrassing topic than family histories. But afterwards, when the old governess had slipped away quietly to her duties, there arose a clamor of derision and disbelief. "It was an impertinence," snapped out the Baron, his protruding eyes taking on a scandalized expression. "Fancy that woman talking like that at our table. She almost told us we were nobodies, and I don't believe a word of it. She is just Schmidt, nothing else. Nothing more. She has been talking to some of the peasants about the old Cernogratz family and has raked up their history and their stories." "She wants to make herself out of some consequence," said the Baroness. "She knows she will soon be past work, and she wants to appeal to our sympathies. Her grandfather, indeed." The Baroness had the usual number of grandfathers, but she never boasted about them. "I dare say her grandfather's a pantry boy or something of the sort in the castle," sniggered the Baron. "That part of the story may be true." So these are your typical haughty, supercilious merchant types who think because they have money they're worthwhile. The merchant from Hamburg said nothing. He had seen tears in the old woman's eyes when she spoke of guarding her memories, or being of an imaginative disposition, he thought he had. "I shall give her notice to go as soon as the New Year festivities are over," said the Baroness. "Till then, I shall be too busy to manage without her. She's going to fire her as the result of that outbreak." But she had to manage without her all the same, for in the cold, biting weather after Christmas, the old governess fell ill and kept to her room. "It is most provoking," said the Baroness, as her guests sat round the fire on one of the last evenings of the dying year. "All the time that she has been with us, I cannot remember that she was ever seriously ill, too ill to go about and do her work, I mean. And now, when I have the house full, and she could be useful in so many ways, she goes and breaks down. One is sorry for her, of course. She looks so withered and shrunken, but it is intensely annoying all the same. Self-pitying. It's her that suffers the most. You break down and die, and it causes me the most suffering. Me most affected." "Most annoying," agreed the banker's wife sympathetically. "It is the intense cold, I expect. It breaks the old people up. It has been unusually cold this year." "The frost is the sharpest that has been known in December for many years," said the Baron. "And of course she is quite old," said the Baroness. "I wish I had given her notice some weeks ago, and then she would have left before this happened to her." "Why, Wappy, what is the matter with you?" The small woolly lapdog had leapt suddenly down from its cushion and crept shivering under the sofa. At the same moment, an outburst of angry barking came from the dogs in the castle yard, and other dogs could be heard yapping and barking in the distance. "What is disturbing the animals?" asked the Baron. And then the humans, listening intently, heard the sound that had roused the dogs to their demonstrations of fear and rage, heard a long-drawn whining howl rising and falling, seeming at one moment leagues away, at others sweeping across the snow until it appeared to come from the foot of the castle walls. All the starved, cold misery of a frozen world, all the relentless hunger fury of the wild, blended with other forlorn and haunting melodies to which one could give no name, seemed concentrated in that wailing cry. "Wolves!" cried the Baron. Their music broke forth in one raging burst, seeming to come from everywhere. "Hundreds of wolves," said the Hamburg merchant, who was a man of strong imagination. Moved by some impulse which she could not have explained, the Baroness left her guests and made her way to the narrow, cheerless room where the old governess lay watching the hours of the dying year slip by. In spite of the biting cold of the winter night, the windows stood open. With a scandalized exclamation on her lips, the Baroness rushed forward to close it. "Leave it open," said the old woman in a voice that, for all its weakness, carried an air of command such as the Baroness had never heard before from her lips. "But you will die of cold," she expostulated. "I am dying in any case," said the voice, "and I want to hear their music. They have come from far and wide to sing the death music of my family. It is beautiful that they have come. I am the last von Cernogratz that will die in our old castle, and they have come to sing to me. Hark, how loud they are calling. The cry of the wolves rose on the still winter air and floated round the castle walls in long-drawn, piercing wails. The old woman lay back on her couch with a look of long-delayed happiness on her face. Go away, she said to the Baroness. I am not lonely anymore. I am one of a great old family. I think she is dying, said the Baroness when she had rejoined her guests. I suppose we must send for a doctor and that terrible howling. Not for much money would I have such death music. That music is not to be bought for any amount of money, said Conrad. Hark! What is that other sound? Asked the Baron, as a noise of splitting and crashing was heard. It was a tree falling in the park. There was a moment of constrained silence, and then the banker's wife spoke. It is the intense cold that is splitting the trees. It is also the cold that has brought the wolves out in such numbers. It is many years since we have had such a cold winter. The Baroness eagerly agreed that the cold was responsible for these things. It was the cold of the open window, too, which caused the heart failure that made the doctor's ministrations unnecessary for the old Fräulein. But the notice in the newspapers looked very well. On December 29th, at Schloss Cernogratz, Schloss means castle in German, Amelie von Cernogratz, for many years the valued friend of Baron and Baroness Grubel. That was the Wolves of Cernogratz. Next story, Louis. Maybe Louis. 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 It would be jolly to spend Easter in Vienna this year, said Strudwarden, or Strudwarden, spelled Strudwarden in English, and to look up some of my old friends there to spend Easter in Vienna. It's about the jolliest place I know of to be at for Easter. I thought we had made up our minds to spend Easter at Brighton, interrupted Lena Strudwarden with an air of aggrieved surprise. You mean that you had made up your mind that we should spend Easter there? Said her husband. We spent last Easter there, and Whitsuntide as well. The year before that, we were at Worthing, and Brighton again before that. I think it would be just as well to have a real change of scene while we were about it. The journey to Vienna would be very expensive, said Lena. You are not often concerned about economy, said Strudwarden, and in any case, the trip to Vienna won't cost a bit more, rather than meaningless luncheon parties, than the rather meaningless luncheon parties we usually give to quite meaningless acquaintances at Brighton. To escape from all that set would be a holiday in itself. As usual, the man wants one thing and the woman wants another. Strudwarden spoke feelingly. Lena Strudwarden maintained an equally feeling silence on that particular subject. The set that she gathered round her at Brighton and other South Coast resorts was composed of individuals who might be dull and meaningless in themselves, but who understood the art of flattering Mrs. Strudwarden, her minions and her acolytes. She had no intention of foregoing their society and their homage and flinging herself among unappreciative strangers in a foreign capital. "You must go to Vienna alone if you are bent on going," she said. "I couldn't leave Louis behind. The dog is always a fearful nuisance in a foreign hotel. Besides all the fuss and separation of the quarantine restrictions when one comes back, Louis would die if he was parted from me for even a week. You don't know what that would mean to me." Lena stooped down and kissed the nose of the diminutive brown Pomeranian that lay snug and irresponsive beneath a shawl on her lap. "Look here," said Strudwarden, "this eternal Louis business is getting to be a ridiculous nuisance. Nothing can be done, no plans can be made, without some veto connected with that animal's whims or convenience being imposed. If you were a priest in attendance on some African fetish, you couldn't set up a more elaborate code of restrictions. I believe you'd ask the government to put off a general election if you thought it would interfere with Lewis's comfort in any way, so this excessive pet worship was a thing back then. 100 years ago. By way of answer to this tirade, Miss Strudwarden stooped down again and kissed the irresponsive brown nose. It was the action of a woman with a beautifully meek nature who would, however, send the whole world to the stake sooner than yield an inch where she knew herself to be in the right. It isn't as if you were in the least bit fond of animals, went on Strudwarden with growing irritation. When we are down at Kerryfield, you won't stir a step to take the house dogs out, even if they're dying for a run, and I don't think you've been in the stables twice in your life. You laugh at what you call the fuss that's being made over the extermination of plumage birds, and you are quite indignant with me if I interfere on behalf of an ill-treated, overdriven animal on the road. And yet you insist on everyone's plans being made subservient to the convenience of that stupid little morsel of fur and selfishness. You are prejudiced against my little Lewis, said Lena, with a world of tender regret in her voice. I've never had the chance of being anything else but prejudiced against him, said Strudwarden. I know what a jolly responsive companion a doggie can be, but I've never been allowed to put a finger near Lewis. You say he snaps at anyone except you and your maid, and you snatched him away from old Lady Peterby the other day when she wanted to pet him for fear he would bury his teeth in her. All that I ever see of him is the tip of his unhealthy-looking little nose peering out from his basket or from your muff, and I occasionally hear his wheezy little bark when you take him for a walk up and down the corridor. You can't expect one to get extravagantly fond of a dog of that sort. One might as well work up an affection for the cuckoo and the cuckoo clock. He loves me, said Lena, rising from the table and bearing the shawl-swathed Lewis in her arms. Are you wondering if the dog even exists? As I am. He loves only me, and perhaps that's why I love him so much in return. I don't care what you say against him. I am not going to be separated from him. If you insist on going to Vienna, you must go alone, as far as I am concerned. I think it would be much more sensible if you were to come to Brighton with Lewis and me, but of course you must please yourself. You must get rid of that dog, said Strudwarden's sister when Lena had left the room. It must be helped to some sudden and merciful end. She's saying that to Strudwarden. Lena is merely making use of it as an instrument for getting her own way on dozens of occasions when she would otherwise be obliged to yield gracefully to your wishes or to the general convenience. So this was a real service dog, if he even exists. He's serving his owner by having her way forced on others who don't want it. I am convinced that, says the sister, and women are very, very well aware of other women's motives. I am convinced that she doesn't care a brass button about the animal itself. When her friends are buzzing around her at Brighton or anywhere else, and the dog would be in the way, it has to spend whole days alone with a maid. But if you want Lena to go with you anywhere where she doesn't want to go, instantly she trots out the excuse that she couldn't be separated from her dog. Have you ever come into a room unobserved and heard Lena talking to her beloved pet? I never have. I believe she only fusses over it when there's someone present to notice her. I don't mind admitting, said Strudwarden, he's talking to his sister, that I've dealt more than once lately in the possibility of some fatal accident putting an end to Lewis's existence. It's not very easy, though, to arrange a fatality for a creature that spends most of its time in a muff or asleep in a toy kennel. I don't think poison would be any good. It's obviously horribly overfed. For I've seen Lena offer it dainties at the table sometimes, but it never seems to eat them. Lena will be away at church on Wednesday morning, said Elsie Strudwarden reflectively. She can't take Lewis with her there, and she is going on to the Dellings for lunch. That will give you several hours in which to carry out your purpose. The maid will be flirting with a chauffeur most of the time, and anyhow, I can manage to keep her out of the way on some pretext or other. That leaves the field clear, said Strudwarden, but unfortunately my brain is equally a blank as far as any lethal project is concerned. The little beast is so monstrously inactive. I can't pretend that it leapt into the bath and drowned itself, or that it took on the butcher's mastiff in unequal combat and got chewed up. In what possible guise could death come to a confirmed basket dweller? It would be too suspicious if we invented a suffragette raid and pretended that they invaded Lena's boudoir and threw a brick at him. We should have to do a lot of other damage as well, which would be rather a nuisance, and the servants would think it odd that they had seen nothing of the invaders. I have an idea, said Elsie. Get a box with an airtight lid and bore a small hole in it, just big enough to let in an India rubber tube. Pop Lewis, kennel, and all into the box and shut it down and put the other end of the tube over the gas bracket. There, you have a perfectly lethal chamber. You can stand the kennel at the open window afterwards to get rid of the smell of the gas, and all that Lena will find when she comes home late in the afternoon will be a placidly defunct Lewis. Novels have been written about women like you, said Strud Warden. You have a perfectly criminal mind. Let's come and look for a box. 2 mornings later, the conspirators stood gazing guiltily at a stout box connected with the gas bracket by a length of India rubber tubing. Not a sound, said Elsie. He never stirred. It must have been quite painless. All the same, I feel rather horrid now it's done. The ghastly part has to come, said Strud Warden, turning off the gas. We'll lift the lid slowly and let the gas out by degrees. Swing the door to and fro to send a draft through the room. Some minutes later, when the fumes had rushed off, he stooped down and lifted out the little kennel with its grim burden. Elsie gave an exclamation of terror. Lewis sat at the door of his dwelling, head erect, and ears pricked, as coldly and defiantly inert as when they had put him into his execution chamber. Strud Warden dropped the kennel with a jerk and stared for a long moment at the miracle dog. Then he went into a peal of chattering laughter. It was certainly a wonderful imitation of a truculent-looking toy Pomeranian, and the apparatus that gave forth a wheezy bark when you pressed it had materially helped the imposition that Lena and Lena's maid had foisted on the household. For a woman who disliked animals but liked getting her own way under a halo of unselfishness, Mrs. Strud Warden had managed rather well. This was a fake all along. Lewis is dead, was the curt information that greeted Lena on her return from her luncheon party. Lewis dead? She exclaimed. Yes. He flew at the butcher boy and bit him, and he bit me too when I tried to get him off, so I had to have him destroyed. You warned me that he snapped, but you didn't tell me that he was downright dangerous. I shall have to pay the boy something heavy by way of compensation, so you will have to go without those buckles that you wanted to have for Easter. Also, I shall have to go to Vienna to consult Dr. Schroeder, who is a specialist on dog bites, and you will have to come too. I have sent what remains of Lewis to Roland Ward to be stuffed. That will be my Easter gift to you instead of the buckles. For heaven's sake, Lena, weep if you really feel it so much. Anything would be better than standing there staring as if you thought I had lost my reason. Lena Strudwarden did not weep, but her attempt at laughing was an unmistakable failure. It's kind of a weird world these people live in. Or maybe it's all just the imagination of Saki. The next story is The Guests. The Guests. The landscape seen from our windows is certainly charming, said Annabel. Those cherry orchards and green meadows and the river winding along the valley and the church tower peeping out among the elms, they all make a most effective picture. The landscape from the windows. There's something dreadfully sleepy and languorous about it, though. Stagnation seems to be the dominant note. Nothing ever happens here. Seed time and harvest, an occasional outbreak of measles or a mildly destructive thunderstorm, and a little election excitement about once in 5 years. That is all that we have to modify the monotony of our existence. Rather dreadful, isn't it? On the contrary, said Matilda, I find it soothing and restful. But then, you see, I've lived in countries where things do happen, ever so many at a time, when you're not ready for them happening all at once. That, of course, makes a difference, said Annabel. I have never forgotten, said Matilda, the occasion when the Bishop of Biquar paid us an unexpected visit. He was on his way to lay the foundation stone of a mission house, or something of the sort. I thought that out there you were always prepared for emergency guests turning up, said Annabel. I was quite prepared for half a dozen bishops, said Matilda, but it was rather disconcerting to find out, after a little conversation, that this particular one was a distant cousin of mine, belonging to a branch of the family that had quarreled bitterly and offensively with our branch about a Crown Derby dessert service. They got it, and we ought to have got it as some silver and some legacy, or else we got it and they thought they ought to have it. I forget which. Anyhow, I know they behaved disgracefully. Now, here was one of them turning up in the odor of sanctity, so to speak, and claiming the traditional hospitality of the East. It was rather trying, but you could have left your husband to do most of the entertaining. My husband was 50 miles up country talking sense, or what he imagined to be sense, to a village community that fancied one of their leading men was a were-tiger. A what tiger? A were-tiger. You've heard of werewolves, haven't you? A mixture of wolf and human being and demon. Well, in those parts, they were were-tigers, so it's presumably India or Southeast Asia somewhere. Or think they have, and I must say that in this case, so far as sworn and uncontested evidence went, they had every ground for thinking so. However, as we gave up witchcraft prosecutions about 300 years ago, we don't like to have other people keeping on our discarded practices. It doesn't seem respectful to our mental and moral position. I hope you weren't unkind to the bishop, said Annabel. Well, of course he was my guest, so I had to be outwardly polite to him, but he was tactless enough to rake up the incidents of the old quarrel and try to make out that there was something to be said for the way his side of the family had behaved. Even if there was, which I don't for a moment admit, my house was not the place in which to say it. I didn't argue the matter, but I gave my cook a holiday to go and visit his aged parents some 90 miles away. The emergency cook was not a specialist in curries. In fact, I don't think cooking in any shape or form could have been one of his strong points. I believe he originally came to us in the guise of a gardener, but as we never pretended to have anything that could be considered a garden, he was utilized as an assistant goat herd, in which capacity, I understand, he gave every satisfaction. When the bishop heard that I had sent away the cook on a special and unnecessary holiday, he saw the inwardness of the maneuver, and from that moment we were scarcely on speaking terms. If you have ever had a bishop with whom you were not on speaking terms staying in your house, you will appreciate the situation. Annabel confessed that her life story had never included such a disturbing experience. Then, continued Matilda, to make matters more complicated, the Guadalipichee overflowed its banks, so this has got to be India, a thing it did every now and then when the rains were unduly prolonged, and the lower part of the house and all the outbuildings were submerged. We managed to get the ponies loose in time, and the syce swam the whole, I don't even know what that is, S-Y-C-E, and the syce swam the whole lot of them off to the nearest rising ground. A goat or two, the chief goatherd, the chief goatherd's wife, and several of their babies came to anchorage in the veranda. All the rest of the available space was filled up with wet, bedraggled-looking hens and chickens. One never really knows how many fowls one possesses till the servants' quarters are flooded out. Of course, I had been through something of the sort in previous floods, but never before had I had a house full of goats and babies and half-drowned hens, supplemented by a bishop with whom I was hardly on speaking terms. It must have been a trying experience, commented Annabel. More embarrassments were to follow. I wasn't going to let a mere ordinary flood wash out the memory of that Crown Derby dessert service. Excuse me. And I intimated to the bishop that his large bedroom with a writing table in it and his small bathroom with a sufficiency of cold water jars in it was his share of the premises, and that space was rather congested under the existing circumstances. However, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when he had awakened from his midday sleep, he made a sudden incursion into the room that was normally the drawing room, but was now dining room, storehouse, saddle room, and half a dozen other temporary premises as well. From the condition of my guest's costume, he seemed to think it might also serve as his dressing room. I'm afraid there is nowhere for you to sit, I said coldly. The veranda is full of goats. There is a goat in my bedroom, he observed with equal coldness and more than a suspicion of sardonic reproach. Really, I said, another survivor. I thought all the other goats were done for. This particular goat is done for, quite done for, he said. It is being devoured by a leopard at the present moment. That is why I left the room. Some animals resent being watched while they are eating. The leopard, of course, was easily explained. It had been hanging round the goat sheds when the flood came, and had clambered up by the outside staircase leading to the bishop's bathroom, thoughtfully bringing a goat with it. Probably it found the bathroom too damp and shut in for its taste, and transferred its banqueting operations to the bedroom while the bishop was having his nap. What a frightful situation, exclaimed Annabel. Fancy having a ravening leopard in the house with a flood all round you. Not in the least ravening, said Matilda. It was full of goat. Had any amount of water at its disposal if it felt thirsty, and probably had no more immediate wish than a desire for uninterrupted sleep. Still, I think anyone will admit that it was an embarrassing predicament to have your only available guest room occupied by a leopard, the veranda choked up with goats and babies and wet hens, and a bishop with whom you were scarcely on speaking terms planted down in your only sitting room. I really don't know how I got through those crawling hours, and of course mealtimes only made matters worse. The emergency cook had every excuse for sending in watery soup and sloppy rice, and as neither the chief goatherd nor his wife were expert divers, the cellar could not be reached. Fortunately, the Guadalupe subsides as rapidly as it rises, and just before dawn the syce came splashing back, with the ponies only fetlock deep in water. Then there arose some awkwardness from the fact that the bishop wished to leave sooner than the leopard did, and as the latter was ensconced in the midst of the former's personal possessions, there was an obvious difficulty in altering the order of departure. I pointed out to the bishop that a leopard's habits and tastes are not those of an otter, and that it naturally preferred walking to wading, and that, in any case, a meal of an entire goat, washed down with tub water, justified a certain amount of repose. If I had had guns fired to frighten the animal away, as the bishop suggested, it would probably merely have left the bedroom to come into the already overcrowded drawing room. Altogether, it was rather a relief when they both left. Now, perhaps, you can understand my appreciation of a sleepy countryside where things don't happen. And that story actually reminded me of that other one where one of the guys was throwing stuff into the bedroom of the other to prevent him from sleeping. I think there was a politician involved in that political campaign. The last story we'll do today is called The Penance. Penance. Octavian Ruddle was one of those lively, cheerful individuals on whom amiability had set its unmistakable stamp. And, like most of his kind, his soul's peace depended in large measure on the unstinted approval of his fellows. Octavian Ruttle. In hunting to death a small tabby cat, he had done a thing of which he scarcely approved himself, and he was glad when the gardener had hidden the body in its hastily dug grave under a lone oak tree in the meadow, the same tree that the hunted quarry had climbed as a last effort towards safety. It had been a distasteful and seemingly ruthless deed, but circumstances had demanded the doing of it. Octavian kept chickens. At least he kept some of them. Others vanished from his keeping, leaving only a few blood-stained feathers to mark the manner of their going. The tabby cat from the large gray house that stood with its back to the meadow had been detected in many furtive visits to the hen coops, and after due negotiation with those in authority at the gray house, a sentence of death had been agreed on. Quote, "The children will mind, but they need not know," had been the last word on the matter. The children in question were a standing puzzle to Octavian. In the course of a few months, he considered that he should have known their names, ages, the dates of their birthdays, and have been introduced to their favorite toys. They remained, however, as noncommittal as the long blank wall that shut them off from the meadow, a wall over which their three heads sometimes appeared at odd moments. They had parents in India. That much Octavian had learned in the neighborhood. The children, beyond grouping themselves garment-wise into sexes, a girl and two boys, carried their life story no further on his behoof. And now it seemed he was engaged in something which touched them closely, but must be hidden from their knowledge. Do you think they're going to revenge their cat? I bet they will. The poor helpless chickens had gone one by one to their doom, so it was meet that their destroyer should come to a violent end, yet Octavian felt some qualms when his share of the violence was ended. The little cat, headed off from its wanted tracks of safety, had raced unfriended from shelter to shelter, and its end had been rather piteous. Octavian walked through the long grass in the meadow with a step less jaunty than usual, and as he passed beneath the shadow of the high blank wall, he glanced up and became aware that his hunting had had undesired witnesses. Three white set faces were looking down at him, and if ever an artist wanted a threefold study of cold human hate, impotent yet unyielding, raging yet masked in stillness, he would have found it in the triple gaze that met Octavian's eye. "I'm sorry, but it had to be done," said Octavian with genuine apology in his voice. "Beast!" The answer came from three throats with startling intensity. Octavian felt that the blank wall would not be more impervious to his explanations than the bunch of human hostility that peered over its coping. He wisely decided to withhold his peace overtures till a more hopeful occasion. 2 days later, he ransacked the best sweet shop in the neighboring market town for a box of chocolates that, by its size and contents, should fitly atone for the dismal deed done under the oak tree in the meadow. The first two specimens that were shown him he hastily rejected. One had a group of chickens pictured on its lid, the other bore the portrait of a tabby kitten. A third sample was more simply bedecked with a spray of painted poppies, and Octavian had the powers of forgetfulness as a happy omen. He felt distinctly more at ease with his surroundings when the imposing package had been sent across to the gray house, and a message returned to say that it had been duly given to the children. The next morning he sauntered with purposeful steps past the long blank wall on his way to the chicken run and piggery that stood at the bottom of the meadow. The three children were perched at their accustomed lookout, and their range of sight did not seem to concern itself with Octavian's presence. As he became depressingly aware of the aloofness of their gaze, he also noted a strange variegation in the herbage at his feet. The greensward, for a considerable space around, was strewn and speckled with chocolate-colored hail, enlivened here and there with gay tinsel-like wrapping or the glistening mauve of crystallized violets. It was as though the fairy paradise of a greedy-minded child had taken shape and substance in the vegetation of the meadow. Octavian's blood money had been flung back at him in scorn. To increase his discomfiture, the march of events tended to shift the blame of ravaged chicken coops from the supposed culprit who had already paid full forfeit. The young chicks were still carried off, and it seemed highly probable that the cat had only haunted the chicken run to prey on the rats which harbored there. Through the flowing channels of servant talk, the children learned of this belated revision of the verdict, and Octavian one day picked up a sheet of copybook paper on which was painstakingly written, "Beast! Rats eated your chickens!" More ardently than ever did he wish for an opportunity for sloughing off the disgrace that enwrapped him and earning some happier nickname from his three unsparing judges. And one day, by chance, a chance inspiration came to him. Olivia, his 2-year-old daughter, was accustomed to spend the hour from high noon till 1 o'clock with her father while the nursemaid gobbled and digested her dinner and novelette. About the same time, the blank wall was usually enlivened by the presence of its 3 small wardens. Octavian, with seeming carelessness of purpose, brought Olivia well within the hail of the watchers and noted with hidden delight the growing interest that dawned in that hitherto sternly hostile quarter. His little Olivia, with her sleepy, placid ways, was going to succeed where he, with his anxious, well-meant overtures, had so signally failed. It was very, very dangerous on his part if he knew any Saki characters. He brought her a large yellow dahlia, which she grasped tightly in one hand and regarded with a stare of benevolent boredom, such as one might bestow on an amateur classical dancing performed in an aid of a deserving charity. Then he turned shyly to the group perched on the wall and asked with affected carelessness, "Do you like flowers?" 3 solemn nods rewarded his venture. "Which sorts do you like best?" he asked, this time with a distinct betrayal of eagerness in his voice. "Those with all the colors over there." 3 chubby arms pointed to a distant tangle of sweet pea. Childlike, or calculatingly like, they had asked for what lay farthest from hand. But Octavian trotted off gleefully to obey their welcome and they're going to kill this little kid. He pulled and plucked with an unsparing hand and brought every variety of tint that he could see into this bunch that was rapidly becoming a bundle. And he turned to retrace his steps and found the blank wall blanker and more deserted than ever, while the foreground was void of all trace of Olivia. Far down the meadow, 3 children were pushing a go-kart at the utmost speed they could muster in the direction of the piggeries. It was Olivia's go-kart, and Olivia sat in it, somewhat bumped and shaken by the pace at which she was being driven, but apparently retaining her wonted composure of mind. Octavian stared for a moment at the rapidly moving group, and then started in hot pursuit, shedding as he ran sprays of blossoms from the mass of sweet pea that he still clutched in his hands. Fast as he ran, the children had reached the piggery before he could overtake them, and he arrived just in time to see Olivia, wondering but unprotesting, hauled and pushed up to the roof of the nearest sty. They were old buildings in some need of repair, and the rickety roof would certainly not have borne Octavian's weight if he had attempted to follow his daughter and her captors on their new vantage ground. "What are you going to do with her?" he panted. There was no mistaking the grim trend of mischief in those flushed but sternly composed young faces. "Hang her in chains over a slow fire," said one of the boys. Evidently they had been reading English history. "Throw her down and the pigs will devour her, every bit except the palms of her hands," said the other boy. It was also evident that they had studied biblical history. The last proposal was the one which most alarmed Octavian, since it might be carried into effect at a moment's notice. There had been cases, he remembered, of pigs eating babies. "You surely wouldn't treat my poor little Olivia in that way," he pleaded. "You killed our little cat," came in stern reminder from the 3 throats. "I'm very sorry that I did," said Octavian, "and if there is a standard of measurement in truce..." Octavian's statement was assuredly a large 9. "We shall be very sorry when we've killed Olivia," said the girl, "but we can't be sorry till we've done it." The inexorable childlike logic, or child logic, rose like an unyielding rampart before Octavian's scared pleading. Before he could think of any fresh line of appeal, his energies were called out in another direction. Olivia had slid off the roof and fallen with a soft, unctuous splash into a morass of muck and decaying straw. Octavian scrambled hastily over the pigsty wall to her rescue, and at once found himself in a quagmire that engulfed his feet. Olivia, after the first shock of surprise at her sudden drop through the air, had been mildly pleased at finding herself in close and unstinted contact with the sticky element that oozed around her. But as she began to sink gently into the bed of slime, a feeling dawned on her that she was not, after all, very happy, and she began to cry in the tentative fashion of the normally good child. Octavian, battling with the quagmire, which seemed to have learned the rare art of giving way at all points without yielding an inch, saw his daughter slowly disappearing in the engulfing slush, her smeared face further distorted with the contortions of whimpering wonder, while from their perch on the pigsty roof, the three children looked down with a cold, unpitying detachment of the Parcae sisters, P-A-R-C-A-E. Probably a historical reference, but one that escapes me. I can't reach her in time, gasped Octavian. She'll be choked in the muck. Won't you help her? No one helped our cat, came the inevitable reminder. I'll do anything to show you how sorry I am about that, cried Octavian with a further desperate flounder which carried him scarcely 2 inches forward. Will you stand in a white sheet by the grave? Yes, screamed Octavian, holding a candle and saying I'm a miserable beast. Octavian agreed to both suggestions. For a long, long time, for a half hour, said Octavian. There was an anxious ring in his voice as he named the time limit. Was there not the precedent of a German king who did open-air penance for several days and nights at Christmas time, clad only in his shirt? Fortunately, the children did not appear to have read German history, and half an hour seemed long and goodly in their eyes. All right, came with threefold solemnity from the roof, and a moment later a short ladder had been laboriously pushed across to Octavian, who lost no time in propping it against the low pigsty wall. Scrambling gingerly along its rungs, he was able to lean across the morass that separated him from his slowly foundering offspring and extract her, like an unwilling cork, from its slushy embrace. A few minutes later, he was listening to the shrill and repeated assurances of the nursemaid that her previous experience of filthy spectacles had been on a notably smaller scale. That same evening, when twilight was deepening into darkness, Octavian took up his position as a penitent under the lone oak tree, having first carefully undressed the part. Clad in a zephyr shirt, which on this occasion thoroughly merited its name, he held in one hand a lighted candle and in the other hand a watch, into which the soul of a dead plumber seemed to have passed. A box of matches lay at his feet and was resorted to on the fairly frequent occasions when the candle succumbed to the night breezes. The house loomed inscrutable in the middle distance, but as Octavian conscientiously repeated the formula of his penance, he felt certain that the three pairs of solemn eyes were watching his moth-shared vigil. And the next morning, his eyes were gladdened by a sheet of copybook paper lying beside the blank wall, on which was written the message, Unbeast. Man, oh man. So in this world, you got to be careful what you do and not leap to conclusions, not do things precipitously, even if they seem to be right. If one were to extract a lesson from that last story, which was the penance. Good Lord. Anyway, I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Saki, the Collected Stories of Hector Hugh Munro, M-U-N-R-O. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon for some more.